Live from Rock Vox Recording Studios in Rochester, New York, metal maniacs around the globe
unite.
Prepare for Metal Mayhem ROC. Now, welcome our hosts, John, the Vernomatic Verno, and Metal Forever Mark.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Metal Mayhem ROC. Tonight, we're into part two of the Ron Stein story, the original owner of Lakeshore Record Exchange, The Metal Years. Ron's joining us live from his home in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Ron, how are you?
I'm doing great tonight, John. How's everything up in Rochester?
Things are good. Things are good. We're enjoying a nice rainy Thursday afternoon, but we're excited about moving forward with this story. And I want to quickly recap where we left off on the first episode. We tracked the beginning parts of your retail career, mid-70s. You got involved with another local guy and were involved in flea markets. Taking it a step further, got involved in played against Sam in another retail endeavor. We pick it up in January 79, and what's going on?
Well, we consummated the deal in January 79 to sell Play It Against Sam to one of the girls who worked there for me. And part of the sale agreement was a non-compete clause so that if I wanted to open up another store, I couldn't do it within a five-mile radius of the address where Play It Against Sam's was on Monroe Avenue. So the first thing I had to do was figure out, okay, when I get ready to open up, where am I going? And so I took a map of city street map of Rochester. I took a compass. I drew out a 5 mile circular radius from where the location of Sam's was. And I figured out what locations were available to me under the covenant not to compete. So it looked like if I wanted to go in the eastern suburbs, I could go to Fairport or someplace like that. If I wanted to go to the western suburbs, I could go to Spencerport, places out that way. And those locations didn't seem really wonderful. I didn't really think I could get the volume I needed out there. The only other thing that was available was either south of the city where there was pretty much nothing, or up in Charlotte, which was outside of the 5 mile radius. If you got a little bit south of Stutzen Street was the 5 mile limit. So anything north of that worked. So I figured, okay, well, next thing is I'm going to go to Charlotte and open up. Now, before I could do that, I needed a couple of things. I needed a suitable opening inventory, which I learned that in Sam's days that was real important. And I also needed fixtures. So for a year and 6-7 months, I hit the garage sale circuit again to get an inventory together. I also had contacts I kept up with that were selling me records in my previous businesses, and they kept selling me things over that hiatus period in 79 and 80, till I got an inventory together that I thought would be suitable to open a store. So then I needed fixtures, and that was just pure luck. One Sunday morning, I was looking through the classified ads, and I never looked through the ads for auctions, but that Sunday morning I did, and I saw that there was an auction going on of all the fixtures of the old J.M. Field store on Spencerport Road. One of the things that was listed in the ad was complete record department fixtures. So at the time I was working still, I had my job as data processing manager. So a friend of mine went to the auction for me, bid on the record department. You know you're doing something right and you know you're doing the right thing when you can get a whole record department's worth of fixtures for $10. Which is what happened when my friend went to bid. There was nobody bidding against him. The bidding started at $10 and it ended at $10 when he ended up getting it. So I had the inventory, and at that point I had the fixtures, and then it became a matter of just finding the exact location where I was going.
Now, there let me ask you, you said there was a no compete. How long time frame did you have to adhere to that?
I think it was 5 years, but it really didn't make any difference because, you know, I was going to open up as soon as I was ready. So, you know, one way or another, it wasn't going to take me 5 years to find another spot to go. And so one way or another, I had to adhere to it when I went to look for a location. So when I went up to Charlotte to look for a spot, there were a couple things I had in mind. It had to be north of Stutzen Street, and it had to have a wall that was facing one direction or the other on Lake Avenue so that you could put up a big sign that said, we buy records. That, if you're running a used record store, generates your traffic coming in. It generates more inventory coming in so you can replenish as you sell your product.
So the business model was still used records and domestic releases at the time.
Right. My initial intention was to just open up, start with used records. And I had it in the back of my mind that I was going to specialize in something, but I really didn't know what yet. But it became apparent after I opened up and was there for a while. Finally found the location there at 4402 Lake Avenue that had the big wall facing the intersection of Lake and Stutson where I could put my sign up. So we went for that location. We opened up Lakeshore at 4402 Lake on October 25th of 1980. And at this point, I have to credit my lovely wife, Jackie, for all the help she was in getting the store open, because I was still working. And so she supervised the putting up of the sign on the wall there. The other thing that she had to do, which was pretty tricky, the fixtures were double-sided fixtures. If anybody has been to Lakeshore, you know that you remember the double-sided record fixtures we had. Those didn't fit in the front door of the 4402 location. So we had to remove the front display windows of the store at 4402 to be able to get the fixtures in. And Jackie spent a whole day there supervising the glass guys and the movers who had to move the fixtures in and then put the window back in.
Explain to me, what are double-sided fixtures?
Well, basically, you know, the browser racks that you have in a record store where you flip through the records.
Yeah.
These fixtures that came from the JM Field store had one browser rack on each side. They were double, so that if you stood on one side of it, you'd browse through one pile of records. And then if you stood on the other side of it, there was a whole different pile that you'd browse through.
Okay, right, right. All right. So Jackie's there facilitating all that.
Right. So finally, we got it to the point where we were ready to open. We opened it on October 25th of 1980. As I say, it was just pretty much a standard used record store at the outset. But a couple things happened after that that really showed me the direction that I needed to go. I was used to, you know, selling records down in the southern part of the city where, you know, at that time it was sort of a hippie neighborhood and a lot of the college students lived down there. The northern part of town, I wasn't familiar with the market, but I figured they want something and they're going to tell me what they want. And they did. But first, before they did, I went down with Jackie in December of 80 to visit her parents in Fort Lauderdale. They had a condo down there where they stayed in the winter. Okay. So when you go to Florida, you can't really, if you're a record collector, you can't go anywhere without checking out the record scene wherever you're going. In checking out the record scene in Fort Lauderdale, I came across a little shop called Open Books and Records. And I walked in there and I looked around and I said, now this is what I want my shop to be like. It wasn't heavy metal, but they were dealing heavily in imports and independent label stuff. They had displays of records all over the walls, you know, new wave posters and things. And I said, now this is really cool. This is what I want my shop to be like. I came home from that trip. And I said, well, okay, I'm going to specialize in something like this, imports and unusual type things. But again, I still really didn't know exactly what it was going to be. And it did not take long until the market told me. So we get to April of 1981, and then the market tells me exactly what it is they're looking for.
And what was that?
Well, a couple of guys started coming into the store who lived up that way. One guy was Bob Thomas, who folks may recognize from Metallic Overdrive as the Warhead. The other was Gino Desiato, who he called himself the Metal General on Metallic Overdrive. Later on, he had a show on WITR much later called Generations Underground, which you might have listened to. But anyway, those two guys were the first. They came into the store two or three different times with British music papers. They were showing me the ads from a British music distributor called Neon Records, which, as it turned out, was the British independent label distributor that handled all the new wave of British heavy metal stuff that was just coming around in the beginning of 1981 and had not gotten to the U.S. yet. So they showed me the lists and they said, this is what we want. Can you get me the Def Leppard Ride Into the Sun EP? Can you get me the Sweet Savage 45? Can you get me Raven Rock Till You Drop album? Can you get me Motorhead, Girl School, you know, all these things that were the new wave of British heavy metal.
Let me interject. Those listening that aren't that familiar with the genre of heavy metal, there is a movement in the late 70s, early 80s called the New Wave of British Heavy Metal. And it was primarily UK English bands that were up and coming. And a lot of these bands were lumped into this new wave of British heavy metal moniker. So that's what Ron's talking about.
Yeah, Iron Maiden, Motorhead, Venom, though, those were the most notable ones to come out of that. But anyway, so they showed me the ads from Neon Records with all the British new wave of heavy metal stuff. And they said, can you get us this? If you can get us this, we can guarantee you that you'll have customers. So I said, well, I really don't know. I've got to talk to some of the import contacts that I have, and I'll see what I can do. So leave it with me, and we'll see what we can get going here. So I made some phone calls to some of the import places that were around at the time. Sky Disc was one, Green World Distribution, Dutch East India Trading. And now, remember, too, the late 70s, early 80s, this is the new wave period. There's a lot of musical snobbery going on there. A lot of the people who were into the all the new wave stuff that was coming along, you know, the sort of stuff like Elvis Costello and Susie and the Banshees and all of those types of things, there was a certain amount of snobbishness going on toward heavy metal. Heavy metal at that time was seen by a lot of people who were into new wave as something that there's no really good way to say this, but this is just the way the perception was. It was something that they felt that was a music of lower class people, and they frowned upon it. They looked down upon it. So when I called all these distributors, I got the same answer from all of them. I ran down the list. I said, can you get me, you know, the Def Leppard's Ride Into the Sun EP? Can you get me Venom, Motorhead, Iron Maiden? And I'd hear a moment of stunned silence on the other end of the phone. And the answer I always got was, well, we don't handle that. You know, real condescending, you know. So I'd say, well, I'll tell you what. How about getting me some of that? Because that is what my customers are asking me for. So how about ordering me some of that?
I want to pause you right there. We got to take a little break. And when we come back, we're just going to hear exactly what happens to Lakeshore in 1981.
This edition of Metal Mayhem ROC is brought to you by Mr. V's Street Style Vending and Special Events Catering. Visit our lunch cart in the College Town District at Strong Memorial Hospital, or hit up the late night weekend location at the corner of Monroe Avenue and South Goodman. Look us up online at MrV'sVending.com for catering prices and availability. That's Mr. V's Street Style Vending and Special Events Catering. Now, back to Metal Mayhem ROC.
We're talking with Ron Stein, original owner of Lakeshore Record Exchange, and he's going over Lakeshore, the metal years. And we're talking about how Ron is ready to launch his inventory and the course he had to take. So, Ron, continue with your story.
Well, after I got put down by all of the domestic distributors, I said, well, you know, I've got customers who want this product. And I'm going to get my customers this product. You guys, you know, those guys can do whatever they want, talk to their buyer, you know, give me a song and dance. I'm going to go get my customers the product that they want. I got up one morning because I was still working at the time, so I had to get up extra early. Now, remember, this is all before the internet. There's no internet. There's no PayPal. There's none of that stuff existed in 1981. I had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and place a call to England, to Neon Records. I talked to a sales rep, and I told the rep on the other end, I said, I've got a shop here in the United States. I have demand for the new wave of British heavy metal stuff. Nobody here seems to want to carry it. How can we do business directly? So they said, well, we can do that. Basically, what you have to do is you have to put together an order for me. We will pick your order. We will call you back and we will tell you exactly how much money you need to send us in pounds sterling in order to pay for the merchandise plus the transatlantic shipping.
Rod, let me ask you something. At this point, now you're a connoisseur of old time rock and roll. Were you a fan of heavy metal? Did you know anything about these bands outside of the word of Bob and Gino? And what kind of research were you able to do in 81?
Well, as far as my personal knowledge and interest in metal, back in the late 60s, early 70s, there was some of the hard rock stuff that I liked. There was a band called Gunn with Adrian Gervitz I always enjoyed. I liked the later Yardbirds with Jimmy Page, you know, things like that. But as far as the new metal that was coming along in 1980, I didn't know anything about that.
What about some of the American metal? You know, not the obscure new wave of British bands, but, you know, back in 81, 82, obviously the Van Halens and the American Aerosmith, I guess that's more rock, that was going on. So any of the American metal bands?
Not really. I wasn't really a big fan of that stuff. If there was anything hard rocking at all that I got into, it was more the bluesy end of things, you know, more like the real late Yardbirds, or Three Man Army was another good one that I liked in the 70s. They were really good. That was the band that happened with Adrian Gervitz after Gunn ended.
There was a few,
but, you know, I wasn't really a metal guy. I was an oldies guy.
Yeah.
And that figures into what happens next, too. But anyways, so they told me, put together an order. Tell us what you want. We'll come back to you with the amount of money in pounds sterling that you got to send us. You go to your commercial bank. You wire transfer us the amount of money in pounds sterling. You know, go to your international department at your commercial bank and wire transfer us the amount of money in pounds sterling. We will then put your order on a plane. You're going to have to clear it through customs at the Rochester airport yourself. You may have to put stickers on all the records saying made in England, because customs is going to look for an apparent, obvious country of manufacture on any piece coming in the country. You know, these are all things you're going to have to do, but if you're willing to do those things, we can definitely do business.
Did you have any idea you were going to have to take those measures to do that?
Well, no, I didn't. But, you know, my attitude in business is you do what's necessary.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
And if they told me that that's what was necessary to get the stuff that I needed, then that's what I was going to do. So we did that. And, you know, I came home and I talked to Jackie and I said, you know, I don't know who I'm dealing with over there. I don't know if they're ever going to send me record number one. If I send them, you know, $500 or $600, this is a gamble. But we're gambling the future of the store, because if they do come through with the product, if they are on the up and up and they send me the stuff I want, we're going to have a very unique inventory that nobody else has anywhere around. So this is a gamble. So I said, well, you know, we got to roll the dice here, because this is what we got to do. This is what we're being asked for, and this is what we have to do. So we did the first order the way the guy at Neon Records said to do it. They shipped the records over. Jackie, again, was instrumental in this because I was still working when the order finally got to the Rochester airport. She went to the Rochester airport and went to customs, opened the box, put all the stickers on that had to be put on, and brought the box back to the shop. I came in there that night, first night that the shipment was there, and I looked in that box and I just looked at that stuff and I said, all my experience in the record hobby tells me this stuff is instantly collectible.
Why is that?
Well, it was independent label stuff. It was hard to get. It had musical integrity to it. It wasn't stuff that was motivated commercially. It was music that was being performed by people who loved the music, a whole new generation of bands who grew out of half the punk era and half the metal of the 1970s. Mm-hmm. It was stuff that was going to be rare. There was no way that this stuff in 10 or 20 or 30 years was not going to be very hard to get. So I looked at that shipment and I said, you know, if I was just in this as strictly somebody who wanted to profit off records, as a collector who was just in it for the money, I would keep a set of these for myself. But I said, I can't do that. This is not my stuff. This is the stuff that Gino and Bob and all the guys who are looking for this stuff are looking for, and they can't get it anywhere else. So my job here is to be a record dealer, a seller of records to people who are looking for the records they want to buy. First thing I did, I called Bob, I called Gino. They came running down to the shop along with a few other people who had left their name and number. And that shipment was pretty much out of there in one day. So we did two or three more shipments like that. We got a reputation very quickly. Before we knew it, we had people coming to us from Rochester, Buffalo, and Syracuse looking for the new wave of British heavy metal stuff that was not available anywhere else. The gamble that we took turned out to be the correct course of action.
So you do the first order, it comes in, you move it fairly quickly, and obviously you start doing more orders. You have a relationship with the import house, you have their trust, they have your trust. At this time, where are we? Summer of 81, fall of 81?
Yeah, we're probably in the summer of 1981 by now, somewhere around in that area there. Summer, maybe early fall, 1981.
Okay, so things are going good. Things are going well.
Well, I achieved my objective of finding out exactly what I was going to specialize in because they told me what they wanted, and I got it for them, and now things are cranking.
Were you complementing the import inventory with the domestic stuff or more commercial European stuff, Scorpions, Judas Priest, the bigger label bands?
Well, as we developed the metal clientele, they also asked us for, the American major label things to go along with the independent stuff that I was getting from England. So, along with the British stuff, we developed an inventory of, the Priest and the Maiden American releases and Ozzy. You know, Blizzard of Oz was out at that time. Mm-hmm. We sold a bunch of those.
Dire of a Madman.
Yeah, exactly. So
you mentioned you got involved with the mail orders. That became popular.
Yes. Yes. Now, that was another thing that that developed early on. A lot of the fellas, Gino and Bob and some of the other ones who were into this, were networked in with other collectors around the country who were also into the new wave of British heavy metal stuff. And there were some of them. I remember Bob Muldowney out in California had a little fanzine called Metal Mania. It was just a homemade, home copied thing that he sent out. He had a mailing list and he sent them out to people who were on his mailing list. And it was, really a hobby fanzine is really what it was.
Yeah.
And there were a number of those springing up around the country at the time. So what we did was we said, well, we've got a unique inventory here. Rochester can't be the only place where people want these titles. So we put ads in a couple of the heavy metal fanzines that we were finding existed. And we ended up with people sending us letters from all over the country, ordering things, looking for certain things, sending us their want lists and saying, okay, this is what I'd like to order. If you you get this, write me back and, well, I'll send you some money. And we'll do this by mail. We had enough of that happening. So that Jackie and I got together with Bob and Gino, and we got together all the stuff that we had in stock at that point and put together a mail order catalog that we sent out to all these the metal collectors from all over the country and some from Canada who were sending us letters, looking for the stuff they were looking for. That's another thing that sort of developed spontaneously was we developed a mail order business. To go along with, the stuff that was starting to boom in the store.
So at this point, you're getting foot traffic from Rochester. The word's spreading about a new import metal outlet. You mentioned Buffalo was coming down. They were getting word. The mail order division was picking up steam. So at this point, we're in the fall, early winter of 81. What else is going on in the store? You're just sort of coasting along, doing the three chapters, and things are good.
Right. Well, at that point, we started to think, because I had also been doing radio. I did community radio on WGMC for quite a few years during the 70s and early 80s. And one of the things that I had been doing just prior to opening the store, I was on Saturday nights with another friend of mine, and we did a show on GMC where we played all different genres of rock and roll, from the stuff that I collected in the 50s, 60s, right through what was present. Mm-hmm. And we get a lot of people calling us, making requests. And a lot of the requests we were getting on the show, even in 1980, were for hard rock and heavy metal. We were getting people calling us for Judas Priest, Breaking the Law, and Ted Nugent, the Wango, the Tango, and, you know, all of the things like that. It occurred to me, you know, there is an audience for this on the radio, on WGMC. It might be something that would be worth thinking about approaching WGMC and doing on a number of levels. Number one, it would give them a program that would probably have a pretty good audience right from the beginning. Number two is it would be a good promotional vehicle for the store and for the music. People could hear the stuff that we're selling. We'd have our name attached to it, so people would know where to go to get it. So the idea hatched to do a heavy metal radio show on WGMC.
And we also heard Accept, Restless, and Wild. The only track we didn't hear from Iron Maiden Killers was the Ides of March on that first side, and we heard everything else. And then we heard the whole first side of Accept, Restless, and Wild. That was going out by request, at least Fast as a Shark was. I guess pretty good on that one. Well, I just got a call from somebody who said that he's been bothered all night by calls from 18 girls and something else, and he told me to put on Metallica Damage Incorporated for Vernomatic's poker party out in Penfield, and I couldn't even understand anything else the guy said at all. So, well, anyway, if you're out there listening, Verno, and everybody else you might be with, I don't know who they are, but you know who they are, and this is going to be the last track of the night, an exception to the rule, so to speak, because I was going to get out of here, but one more track won't hurt. This is Damage Incorporated.
There's a clip of Bob the Warhead that Ron was talking about, one of the early metal consultants from the Metallic Overdrive show. I just wanted to play that clip. So you start the show, and what kind of reaction did you get from it?
Well, what we did, first of all, when we approached GMC, we made a deal with them where we would give them half cash and half records out of the store every week for underwriting. So that was the deal. And it's something that kind of was in the cards for us to do it. Just the fact that Bob was one of the first guys to come in who pointed me in the direction of doing this. And it turned out that he was the absolute ideal DJ to put on Metallic Overdrive. I couldn't have thought of anybody better to start Metallic Overdrive than Bob the Warhead. He was just fantastic. So was Gino. He was the metal general during the early days of the show, and he was great too. And as the show went forward, we got a few other guys involved. Tim the Executioner, Jim the Cranker, and as time went on, there were some other guys. Eventually, down the line, it went from one night Saturday to two nights Friday and Saturday, and it just kind of grew along with the store. It was just a great thing to promote the store, to promote the music, and it just was a natural progression of things.
It was an excellent tool, and besides being the host of Metal Mayhem RLC, I have a history with both Ron and Bob and the whole Lakeshore experience. In that clip, you could probably noticed that he was doing a dedication to myself. The whole DJ crew over at Metallic Overdrive were about 7 to 8 years older than I am. They led the way. They were very knowledgeable, and they were the type of tool that was a huge compliment to what Lakeshore was doing. So we'll explore a little more on Overdrive in a little bit, but I just wanted to interject that that's why I was doing Bob was giving me a dedication, because later on in my early broadcast career, I got involved in radio as well. So just wanted to establish that. So go on.
Yeah, and as I understand it, Metallic Overdrive, I mean, I moved out of Rochester in 1988, but as I understand it, even before I moved, Metallic Overdrive inspired a whole lot of people to do heavy metal radio, not only the way you do it as a podcast, but also over the air on all the various community stations around Rochester. So it's a very gratifying thing that, you know, the things that we did with the music and with Metallic Overdrive really had a positive influence on so many people for such a long period of time. You know, that that really makes me feel good that, you know, we were able to create something like that, that had such a long lasting positive effect on people's lives, and the fact that they could listen to it, have fun with the music, listening to the show, you know, something to do on their weekends. It just it's very gratifying to look back on that and know that, you know, we started something like that.
I went through the Vernomatic vaults and I dug this old commercial out. See if you remember it, Ron.
4410 Lake Avenue in Rochester. The Lakeshore Record Exchange carries rocking ports and features heavy metal, progressive, and new wave recordings. The Lakeshore Record Exchange, 4410 Lake Avenue, is a proud supporter of Metallic Overdrive on 90.1 FM WGMC.
Yeah, I sure remember that.
So where we are, we're in summer of 1982, spring of 1982.
Metallic we're in the spring of 82.
Shop's doing well. What's going on now?
Well, we got to a point where the store had grown from all of this to where we had outgrown our original spot at 4402 Lake Avenue. It turned out that same strip of stores there, two doors down at 4410, there had been a pizza place in there that went out of business, and the location was available there. Same landlord and everything, just two doors down. It was, again, something that kind of happened, you know, as a stroke of luck that that spot became available for us just when we needed it. We moved the store two doors down. We brought in some extra fixtures that we had in storage. Again, I have to thank Jackie for, you know, coordinating that move, you know, during the time that I was still working. She did all that stuff. She ran the store during the day. Anybody who shopped with us remembers Jackie from running the store during the week. You know, she was with me there on Saturdays. She was an invaluable asset, an invaluable help to the business. I could not have done Lakeshore without Jackie. So, you know, she quarterbacked the move and, you know, was running the store during the day the whole time. So,
props to Jackie.
Yes. Props to Jackie for all that she did. But, anyway, so we moved the store over to 4410, in April of 1982 and, just continued with the growth. Here we are in the new location in the spring of 1983. And, so things are going good, and then something else very notable happens. I get a call from a gentleman who ran a studio down in downtown Rochester called Music America Studio. Down there, I think it was on East Avenue, corner of Sio Street or somewhere in that area. And he tells me his name is Paul Curcio, and he's a record producer. He's just moved to Rochester. He worked on the West Coast previously with the Doobie Brothers and some other bands on the West Coast. And he is working at Music America, recording a band from San Francisco called Metallica. And he said, they're into all the stuff that you guys are selling out there, and I'd like to bring them out, and they'd like to see the shop. So that is what happened. One day, Paul Curcio pulled up across Lake Avenue with a van, and out pops Metallica. And,
so at this point, did you have any communication with Metallica's management, or is it just strictly Curcio as the producer and studio owner got in touch with you?
At that point, just Curcio.
Okay.
You know, the first time they came in the shop, Curcio brought them down, and they came in, they looked around, they pulled out a few records. Cliff Burton and Lars Ulrich pulled out some records. I think some Thin Lizzy albums, a couple of things out of the collectible bin. I think maybe like Sir Lord Baltimore or one of those proto metal kind of things that we had in our collectible hard rock bin. So, you know, I said, you know, good to meet you guys. I'm glad you're here. Glad you came out to see us. I said, you know, glad, you know, to help you guys out with some records. I know you guys are just starting out. So, you know, it's my pleasure. You know, keep the albums and enjoy them, and hope they, you know, influence you guys a little bit or do some good.
So at this point, these, you know, Metallica, they're in their early 20s. They're just kids. 1,500 right. miles across the country in this, you know, middle-sized America town doing the album. Besides right. coming to your shop and, you know, checking out a record store, did you have any other kind of involvement with them socially outside the record store, in the studio, anything like that?
Well, I did go down to Music America one time when they were, I think they were recording Metal Militia the day I was there. So I watched them record a little bit. And then they came back to the shop a second time. And when they came back to the shop a second time, Lars and James approached me and they said, you know, Ron, we're in kind of a pickle here. We need some road cases. We're going to be touring soon. And we don't have any road cases to go on the road. So we're wondering if maybe you could help us out somehow. So I said, well, I hadn't thought about that. That's definitely a possibility. I said, are you guys available to stop by the house sometime and we can talk turkey about this? So they said, yeah. Lars and James came to my house on Armstrong Avenue in Irondequoit. And we spent an afternoon talking a little bit about, you know, the music business in general. So, you know, they were trying to, you know, go to any possible source that they could find to get the things that they needed. So they came to me and they said, you know, if you'd be interested in doing something, let me give you the phone number of our manager and you can work something out with him.
Did you do it?
Yes, I did.
Did you go down to Jersey and meet the manager?
Well, James gave me Johnny Z's phone number. I called Johnny Z. He was very receptive to the idea of doing a deal with me where I would be loaning Metallica some money to get the road cases that they were needing. He said, come on down and we'll hash something out. I took a day off from my job. I was still working. I hopped on a plane. Johnny Z met me at Newark Airport, and he took me to his house in Old Bridge, and we hammered out a deal. Basically, for certain considerations and certain collateral, I loaned Metallica the money that they needed for their road cases.
Those listening, Johnny Z is John Zazula. He was the founder of Megaforce Records, and he was the gentleman that enticed Metallica to come across the country when he got the No Life to Leather demo back in 1982, brought him to Jersey, and about a month later sent him up to Rochester to do the album. So that's who Johnny Z is. So Ron Stein's down in New Jersey, wheeling and dealing, supporting Metallica, getting them on the road. And where does that bring us up at Lakeshore Record Exchange?
Well, you know, basically, you know, we did that deal, and Metallica then, you know, went on the road on that, on their tour. I eventually did get repaid. I'm not going to go into detail as to what the consideration was for me doing that. Obviously, you don't loan somebody money without getting something in return. Normally it's interest if you're a bank and you're loaning people money. But there was consideration coming my way. Turned out that it was a good thing later on that I had that consideration, as we'll find out probably in the next episode that we do here. You know, so that was basically it. And, you know, as far as my further contact with Metallica, I met with them again when they came up here on the Kill 'Em All for One tour that played at the Riverboat in 1983.
August
of 83, right? Paul Curcio really did that show in Rochester at the Riverboat. He was really the promoter for that. He was nice enough to put my name on the tickets as a co-promoter, because, you know, we were in a position to sell a lot of tickets for that show with Metallic Overdrive going, and with the store being, you know, the place people were going for the underground metal.
Isn't there a misprinted concert ticket in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame of that show with the Lakeshore Record Exchange?
Well, the ticket's not misprinted. The little card that they put in the Metallica display is misprinted. They said the Riverboat was located in Syracuse.
Oh, that's what it is.
And I called them afterwards, you know, after I had sent them that ticket for their display, and I told them, and I don't think they ever fixed it. So I don't, you know.
So you make it down to the riverboat, check in with the guys, and that's basically the last you've heard of them. And that was it?
Yeah, pretty much. They were, you know, not the most talkative that night, shall we say. They were not the most gregarious, if you know the meaning of that word. And, you know, it was a little bit on the chilly side, shall we say. I never have understood why. If you would think that when somebody's starting out, you loan them money to help them, you would think that maybe you'd get a little bit of a 16th of an inch thank you on one of their album covers. I'm still waiting to see that.
Well, that's 40 years ago. I know if you're going to be waiting for a while. But
yeah,
that's a one hell of a timeline so far. You know,
yeah. Now, one other thing I want to mention about the trip down to New Jersey with Johnny Z. Yeah. When I was down there at his house in Old Bridge, he had a box of the first pressings of the Kill 'Em All album. It was just in the process of being issued. It hadn't come out in the U.S. yet when I was down there. And he had a box of the first pressings of the Kill 'Em All album that came out first in England on the Music for Nations label. So I asked him, you know, can I take one of those with me? We'll play it on the radio in Rochester on Metallic Overdrive, and we'll get some demand going. So he said, yeah, just take one. I can't spare you more than one because this is all I have right now. I took that copy of Kill 'Em All. I gave it to Bob and Gino. I said, here you go, play it. And that was the first Metallica record that ever was in the city of Rochester, ever.
Do you still have it?
I don't. It's in the hands of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That particular piece, that particular vinyl that Johnny Z gave you?
Yes.
Okay.
For the same reason that the ticket from the Kill 'Em All for One show is also in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Let's just say that after everything was said and done, I wasn't a real big fan of Metallica.
So we're August 83. It's been a great almost 3 years of the Lakeshore Record Exchange. There are two locations. The fall of 83 comes. Basically, what goes on at the store at this period and what's on the horizon for Lakeshore?
Well, in the fall of 1983, I think that's when we start with the radio station that you referred to. I think we'd been with them earlier, but it's being placed in this particular time frame here. We started with the radio station Woo Woo in Buffalo. Actually, they weren't in Buffalo. They were, I guess, about 20 miles outside of Buffalo, but their signal also got into Rochester. So they had a heavy metal show on Monday evenings on Woo Woo, and we put ads on there. And so we started to get more people, even than before, coming to us from Buffalo, looking for the metal stuff. And also we had in the ads that we sold progressive rock albums, and we got some people coming looking for that. We kept being told the same thing by all the people that came in from Buffalo. They kept telling us, you would do really great to open up a store in Buffalo. There's only one store in Buffalo that has anything at all in underground metal, and they don't have 1/20th of what you have here. And there's a big demand for it in Buffalo, and we think that you should seriously think about opening a Buffalo store because you would do really well there. Of course, advertising on Woo Woo on the metal show, we were able to get the same kind of promotion into the city of Buffalo that we were getting on Metallic Overdrive. So at that point, we had demand for a store, and we had the means to promote that store. So what we started to think about at that point, at the end of 1983, was opening a second store in the city of Buffalo.
Sounds like a winning combination, and it sounds like that has the makings of episode 3 of Ron Stein, the original owner of Lakeshore Record Exchange, the metal years. We're going to look into that next week on Metal Mayhem ROC. Ron, I want to thank you for taking some time out tonight and chatting with us here at Metal Mayhem.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, John. I'm real, real happy that you contacted me and asked me to do this because you're the first one ever from Rochester who's ever called me and asked me to tell my story. So I've been waiting a long time to have a platform for this, and I really do appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. We'll look you up next week. But before we leave, I'm going to play another clip from the Metallic Overdrive radio show that Lakeshore Record Exchange underwrote, produced, conceived, and indirectly financed. So this is the Warhead giving another shout out to the Vernomatic. We will see you next week on Metal Mayhem ROC.
Okay, there you have some hot metal from Merciful Fate. And that was Doomed by the Living Dead. That's going on to Larry from the Mortuary and the Cranker. I don't know, the request situation down here tonight is pretty hectic. We got about 10 people taking requests and scribbling down and everything. So you're just going to have to kind of don't take us too seriously down here tonight. Wasp music in there and Ball Crusher from the second LP, The Last Command. And that's going out to Pat. And we couldn't play the one you wanted to hear, Pat. That's a little bit too rude. We used to play it, but we got busted. So no more. Blessed Death in there and Eternal War from the Kill or Be Killed LP going out to Pickles. And also in there, we heard music from Wizard and Future Nights, and that's the title track, and that one's going out to Pickles. Okay, I'm going to hand it over.
Pickles must be quite a guy.
How do you know it's a guy?
Could be a girl.
That's right, she
is. I know Pickles personally.
Yeah, you should. Okay, I'm going to hand it over to the Hammer. He's going to be with you for a while. I'll still be here. I'll just be kind of floating around here and there. But he's going to take you through some of the requests. I don't know. Can you make out any of that stuff?
I can make it out. I got some pickles coming up. I got dill pickles.
Okay, Vlasic. Well, we're going to hand it over to him anyway. But we do have some music from who?
Pickles. Oh, Overkill, Rotten to the Core.
Thank you for listening to Metal Mayhem ROC. Check out our website, metalmayhemroc.com or metalforever.com for more information on upcoming concerts, interviews, archives, and more. Please rate and review the show wherever you get podcasts.